that hit ya.
The only vocalist in history to net Grammy Awards in three different categories, jazz, pop, and R&B, Al Jarreau was a virtuoso performer who balanced smooth lyricism with his own innovative brand of vocalese. Initially, emerging in the late 60s, Jarreau drew audiences with his dynamic blend of jazz, balladry, and vocalese. A biography of the Milwaukee-born singer and percussionist Al Jarreau gives some idea of his versatility. During a 60-year career that won him seven Grammys, he mastered so many genres that he defied stereotyping. What forces shaped that versatility? We'll find out in a moment. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is Kurt Dietrich, Professor Emeritus of Music at Ripon College and the author of Never Given Up, The Life and Music of Al Jarreau, published in 2023 by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you very much.
I suppose we'll start with Milwaukee to find out the answer to our question there as to what shaped the remarkably versatile Al Jarreau. It would take us back to Milwaukee in the 1940s.
Yeah, Al was born in 1940. He was the fifth of six children. His father was a minister, a Seventh-day Adventist minister, although by the time Al was conscious of his father and his work, his father had left the church. But he grew up in this family that was filled with music, and his father was a terrific singer. His mother was the prototypical church pianist organist. And when Al was young, he would go to choir practice, church choir practice every week, and sit next to his mother on the bench and listen to that music and probably sing along. His older siblings, his next oldest sibling was 6 years older than he was, and then there were three older than that, including two boys who also were quite the singers. And the girls sang too. It was two boys, then two girls, and then Al and his younger brother. And the family was always doing music. Al, in fact, was advertised as singing at a garden party in his neighborhood in central Milwaukee when he was 4 years old. And that sort of thing continued. There's a fairly famous episode, just because it's been kept alive through a photograph and through stories, of the family giving a concert as a family when Al was 7 years old, and all of them sang. His younger brother danced also, and his father, of all things, besides being a singer, played the musical saw. And one of his big hits, if you can put it that way, that he played accompanied by his wife, he played popular songs, but he also did Ave Maria. And so he was an interesting musician, never a professional. But there was music around Al all the time, and his brothers sang in his older brothers sang in vocal groups when Al was a kid. And so then Al went to school in Milwaukee. He went to Henry Palmer Elementary School, and he ended up at Lincoln High School. And Lincoln High School every year had what they called a Follies show, and it was, in effect, a review. And they sang and danced and had a pit orchestra and did songs mostly from fairly recent musicals. And Al was a big star in those during his high school days.
I got the impression from your book, Kurt, that even by the age of 10, Al decided, made up his mind, that he wanted to be a singer.
Well, that's what he said later, and we really have no reason to doubt him. I think there were plenty of different avenues open to him as to how his life might go. But, yeah, he clearly had the gift. And one of those gifts, and if there are any musicians listening in, musicians who worked with Al, who I talked with later, said he could pretty much remember every song he'd ever heard, the words, and he knew how the chords went too. He never learned how to read music, but he could hear all the chords. And so, you know, that's some kind of gift that even most musicians don't quite understand, that he could remember an incredible number of songs and lyrics and so forth. And he definitely seemed to be destined for a musical career early on. Although in high school, he was an all-city baseball player, and he placed in the state cross-country meet, and he played basketball. So that wasn't – and he was in student government. He was the president of his class for 3 years. So music wasn't the only thing that he did or could have done.
What was his major when he went to Ripon College?
He was a psychology major, and he never took a music course while he was at Ripon College. He did a lot of music, though. His sophomore year, he and three other students founded a vocal quartet, and they worked quite a bit during the next few years, singing at practically every on-campus event that they possibly could. But they were doing clubs and country clubs and I'm sure miscellaneous performances during those 3 years, including, you know, they would go to Fond du Lac and sing there, and they would probably go to Oshkosh. They had a regular job at a country club in Green Lake, which is only 8 miles away from Ripon, and even got down to Milwaukee and did a few gigs in Milwaukee where Al was already connected to the music community.
Were they approached at one point by Columbia Records?
They were. And that came at the end of Al's senior year and the senior year of the other two men who were in the group. There was a woman who was in the group also who was an underclass person. But they somehow got a special invitation to go to the Notre Dame Collegiate Jazz Festival, which was one of the very first important college jazz festivals in the country. And they were invited to go there, and they were not in the competition. The competition was for instrumental groups, but they were asked to come down there as I don't know what you would call it, a novelty group or something, a special attraction maybe. And they performed, and yes, word has it that there was somebody from Columbia Records there who said, we'd like to record you.
And?
Well, it wasn't going to happen. Al was game. One of the other guys in the group had been in the reserve officer training program. So he owed his life to the U.S. Army for the next couple of years. Another guy sort of thought, you know, what I want to do is go to graduate school. And the woman who was in the group, she was still an undergrad. So it just wasn't going to happen.
So you have this great singer, Al Jarreau, and this quartet has fallen apart. Where does he go?
He goes to graduate school. From what I understand, and not all of this is in the book, but he went back to Milwaukee and he was working steady the whole summer after he graduated. He was working at the Pfister Hotel singing, and he was probably thinking, well, maybe I can make something happen here. I can always get a day job. But he was approached by some people who said, you know, there's a special program here that helps people who want to go to graduate school. And by that, I mean financially. And so I'm not sure how they talked him into it, but he ended up going to the University of Iowa and getting a master's degree in rehabilitative counseling.
A good adjunct to psychology, I would think.
Right.
And is he singing in Iowa then?
He was singing in Iowa, and so the university is in Iowa City, but it's a short drive to Cedar Rapids, which is the major city in that part of the state. And there was a jazz club there. There are some funny things about that jazz club that you can read about in the book. The guy who ran it was the drummer a former wrestler at the University of Iowa and trying to run the club while doing the music from behind the drum set and quite a character. But yeah, this club had jazz always. And I'm not sure if they had other kinds of music, but they did do jazz. So after Al had been in the area for a while, he started doing weekends down there.
Was he a percussionist also?
No. Now, that percussion thing, if you look on some of the albums, it says Al Jarreau, vocal and percussion. I shouldn't say he wasn't a percussionist because you can see plenty of pictures of him with a shaker, one of the African shakeras or whatever, you know, there are various names for those. And he accompanied himself doing that, especially later on when he was just doing a duo with a guitar player. But you see on the albums where it says Al Jarreau percussion, and what they mean there is he was doing vocal percussion.
Slapping his face or what?
Well, not slapping his face, but making percussion noises. And in fact, he sounds remarkably like a conga player a lot. He also made sounds that sounded like the cuica, the little talking drum thing, which there are a couple records. I'm not sure if it's him or an actual instrument doing some of the noises. So that was one of his things, is that they said Al Jarreau, vocal percussion, and that's what that was about. But
what's the earliest recording we would have of him?
Well, there is a recording from 1965 when he was still in Iowa, and I wrote about it in the book, but it's not one of the albums that was an official release, which I did special entries on each of those. Because once that album was out, it disappeared because who had ever heard of Al Jarreau? But then once he made it, it reappeared on a whole lot of different labels and obviously bootlegs. And we're not sure who really owned it, but Al Jarreau never owned it. And when a number of those came out, his management tried to buy the rights and, you know, keep the other people from putting out those albums, but they were unsuccessful. And you can still find that record on a whole bunch of different no-name labels out on the internet. But at that time, he was singing jazz standards. And so it was definitely different from what we know of Al Jarreau and his repertoire.
But he can't really make it big, assuming that's his goal, in the Midwest in the early 60s.
Correct.
So he goes to California.
Right.
And we will follow him to California and hear a lot of his music, too, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Kurt Dietrich, and we're looking at the life and music of Al Jarreau, Milwaukee-born phenomenon who defies categorization, and that could be a good thing or it could also be a drawback, and we'll get into that a bit also. Now, he has gone to California, going commercial, of course, but at what point is he actually writing any of his own lyrics or songs, for that matter?
Well, it's difficult to know exactly, but he went out to California in 1964. Interestingly, it was a guy who owned a club in Milwaukee. It opened a club out west and said, why don't you come out here? And so Al and the piano player he had worked with in Milwaukee went out there. Al got a day job there as a rehabilitative counselor for the state of California. So he followed his degree. But he started singing shortly after that, weekends, nights, whatever. And so that's how he ended up out there. But this didn't mean that he was ready for his career to take off. He kept that day job for a number of years. He worked with a great pianist named George Duke in a club in San Francisco for a number of years. But eventually, it was 1968, he ran into a guitar player, Julio Martinez, and through some odd circumstances, they started working together, just the two of them as a duo. And they continued to work clubs in the Bay Area. And at some point, Al gave up on his day job, and he was making enough on the weekends that he could afford to do that. They went to Southern California and worked clubs and did this and that. He actually did the Playboy Club circuit for a couple of years.
He did a lot of music.
That's right. And he toured all over the country doing the Playboy Clubs. But it wasn't until 1975, so this was 10 years after he went to the West Coast, that finally somebody said, we need to hire this guy for our label. He had been a minor sensation in Southern California for a number of years and had built up a real following. And during that time, he had started writing and playing his own songs. And eventually, after many people, including Warner Brothers, had refused him, saying, we don't know what to do with this guy. Finally, they heard him again and said, we've got to sign him no matter what.
There's a great line in your book in that regard. The executive, Warner executive, says, hey, look, I have no idea what we would do with this guy, but we have to sign him. What a great line.
Yeah. Yeah.
So at this point, is he developing his own image and his own sound?
He certainly was. And some might argue that his own sound was best represented on his very first album in his whole career. That was the one album that was exclusively Al Jarreau compositions and lyrics. And he co-wrote lots of songs, and he wrote lyrics to almost all those and a whole lot of other songs also. But that first album, which was We Got By, which was released in 1975, that was all Al Jarreau songs and lyrics. And the title cut of that, it's a lightly fictionalized version of what it was like growing up in Milwaukee for Al Jarreau.
Oh, I hardly had a belly full. Never knew a new bicycle. Hand me down books and shoes. They brought the Yuletides in July. I rode a bus, a train, sometimes strolling for miles to a movie show, singing the song Shoo-be-doo, while birds and rich folks flew right on by. But we got by. We got by. We got by. Lord knows we got by. Winter wishes wait till June. We brighten July with that hot dog fun. Tell your mama you're with Sue, baby. You bring some beans and I will find the wine. Them neon lights will brighten too. And sneaking back home with this girl named Joe, I hurried down to say I do. And instead, my first man shouted in the eye. Oh, but we got by. We got by. Oh, we got by. Lord knows we got by. Sometimes I say, belly full, y'all, and finally is that new bicycle, working, praying June to June, and mama's got L.A. gleaming in her eye. Oh, and we got that,
hugging and hugging and rubbing and sucking and bugging, laying, praying, swaying, lifting and fretting and getting, begetting, lying and flying and trying and dying and sighing. We got back, yeah, yeah. We got back. Oh, we got back. Yes, Lord, help me sing. Didn't we get there? Thank you, Mama. Provider. Thank you, Papa. Causing me to tremble.
Was We Got By, this song, this quintessential song, you might say, was it marketed as a jazz song?
I don't know. I can tell you this, that at that time in his career, Al Jarreau's records were in the jazz bin at the local record store. And so that's what people who were buying them thought they were getting was jazz. Clearly, there's a heavy sort of gospel-y R&B presence in this tune. But then towards the end, there was that big improvised section where he was just singing away with, you know, sort of scatting.
Yeah, scat I was going singing. To say, kind of proto-scat there.
Yeah, yeah. And he had a whole thing that he did like that, not so much on a tune like this, but, you know, a slow tune like this, a ballad, it could have been played on just about any popular music radio show at that time. And in fact, in the 70s, there were radio shows that were playing a wide range of music.
In the 70s, yes.
Rather than just this is jazz and this is R&B and this is pop. So it was a different scene back then.
Now, he was still recording jazz standards, though, which is kind of how he started recording.
He was not recording jazz standards.
He was not.
No. He ended up doing some jazz tunes, and we'll listen to one shortly. But these are decidedly not jazz standards that you expect singers to sing. So we're going to listen to Take Five, which was a famous instrumental back in 1959 for the Dave Brubeck Quartet. Paul Desmond, the saxophonist, wrote this tune. And it didn't have words, and Al wrote his words for it. But he does a lot of other things besides just singing the words to this also. And this piece was on his third record, which was Look to the Rainbow. This is one for which he won a Grammy as a jazz artist. But the other songs on this album, which was a double album, it was recorded live in Europe at a variety of locations on a whole tour that he did there. But this was the one jazz tune on the whole set. And the others were more like We Got By and some other kind of pop things that we could listen to, pop-ish things or R&B-ish things. But Take Five is definitely a jazz tune, but not a tune that any other vocalist had been singing at that time.
Or maybe has sung since.
Well, can't you count a word? Boop 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 bo
mega boom, and the pound, the pound, and the doo 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 doo. Say the boom, the pound, the pound, and the doo 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 doo. Da 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 da. Baby, 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 the pound, the pound, you don't know about all the love. Just have to take a little time out with me. Oh, just take five, just take five. Just have a busy day and take the time out to see that I'm alive, I'm alive. Although I'm going out on my way just so I can pass by each day. Not a single word do we say. It's a pantomime and out of time. Still, I know all eyes are for me. Half a tingle down to my feet. When your smile gets much too discreet, it sends me on my way. Now, wouldn't it be better not to be so polite? Would you could offer a light? You start a little conversation now, it's all right. When you're taking five. A little time out with me, the pretty baby, take five. You stop your busy day and take the time out to see, girl, that I'm alive. Oh, I'm going out of my way just so I can pass by each day. Not a single word do we say. It's a pantomime, not a time. Still, I know why lights are for me. Half a tingles down to my feet. When you're smiling, rush to the street, it's suddenly gone away. Wouldn't it be better not to be so polite? Princess and mama, you know that you could offer me a light. Start a little conversation now, it's all right. Will you take five?
Well, as you say, Kurt, there's a lot going on there. But some of it, though, I mean, overall, I kind of get a feel like a Brazil 66 or something, getting into the kind of the you know, the Latin sound that was popular in the 60s and subsequently.
Well, maybe. And he had already in his career done a number of those Brazilian tunes, and especially when he was working just as a duo with a guitar player, he was doing Brazilian tunes, and he said, yeah, that was my Brazilian period. But this feel is actually quite close to what Dave Brubeck did back in 1959, but it just sounds so much different with this band, electric bass, you know, that kind of sound. There was a vibes player who was putting some color in also. But, you know, just the fact that it's in five, too, a meter of five rather than a straight, what we think of as a dance rhythm, adds a certain element to it. And frankly, I never thought of that tune as sounding Brazilian, but you do have a point there. So anyway, but that was the real jazz side of Al Jarreau at this point in his career.
What kind of image does he have? I mean, if you look at the early pictures of him in particular, he's all dressed in white. He looks almost like a post-grad student, you know, on a kind of a junket performing. And this was a time, of course, when a lot of pop musicians in particular, who knows what you were going to get in terms of the image.
Yeah. And actually, he, in those early days, yeah, you would see him dressed in white, but you'd see him dressed in various things. And the cover image of the book is from 1980, and he's at the PAC in Milwaukee, and, you know, he's wearing a tight-fitting shirt, and he's got a nice pair of slacks on. One thing to keep in mind that's of interest, I think, was so his first record deal wasn't signed until he was 35 years old, which could hardly happen anymore, I think. But it could back then, and it did. But he still looked great. He looked like an athlete, which he was. He had been an athlete in high school and college. And on stage, he was very smooth. He didn't specifically dance in the way that Michael Jackson did, let's say, but you can see him on some concert films doing a little moonwalking. And he just moved very easily and looked sleek. And he always looked, until his later years, he always looked younger than he actually was.
He was starting to put out, by the time we get to the 80s, he seems to be putting out an album just about every year.
That's right. And he could only do that if those albums were selling and making money. And they were. In the first couple albums, were sort of slow going, but once Look to the Rainbow won the Grammy, that changed things. And then the album, starting with the album This Time from 1980, the next few albums sold really well and made Al Jarreau a star, as much as a star as he ever would become.
This Time, that album had that, well, the title song for your book, for a matter of fact, Never Given Up.
Right. And this song was the first track on the album. And I used the title for the book because it sort of expressed Al's way of looking at life. In fact, the song is a love song, and he isn't going to give up on this love. Nonetheless, it does express in that phrase what his career was all about, as he was not going to give up. And the song, once it gets on for a while, you can say that it sort of transcends just this love affair that he's not going to give up on. And importantly, too, you're going to hear immediately that the sound of this track is way different. So it was the 80s, and there's a lot of synthesizer sounds. But it's just a good pop song.
Straight pop?
I guess so. And people have observed that Al Jarreau, no matter what he sang, and this is definitely a pop tune, but he brought a jazz sensibility to it, which is to say you would never hear him sing a song exactly the same way twice, and he would change the phrasing, and he would, you know, if we saw this printed out on music, he wouldn't sing the line the way it was printed out on the music. He would be embellishing it and taking it here and taking it there. And that was just the way he sang.
How would you describe, and this is from that same period, 1980, 81, 82, 83, that song Alonzo? Does that come from the Breaking Away album?
No, this is still from This Time. And this song, I would like to have this in the show just because it's a different kind of song. This one, again, probably Alonzo was Al Jarreau, and you'll hear him talking about, you know, being around the Bay, that is San Francisco Bay. And it also talks about him striving and having a quest, so to speak. So from that standpoint, it has some of the themes that came back over and over in his music. But also, this is a pop tune, but it's a rather sophisticated one, and especially the ending, the coda on this, is quite what we describe in the jazz community as out. I mean, the harmony is quite sophisticated. So it's a different kind of song, but it's another song that he really sells. You know, here's a singer selling a song when they're singing it. So this was, you know, like the third or fourth track on this album. You heard Never Giving Up, a pop tune. And now this one's not really like that. And one of the things you're going to hear in this track towards the beginning is you're going to hear what sounds like flutes, and that's Al Jarreau singing.
There's a lot going on in that one, too. And the flute sound that you mentioned, Kurt, was actually Al Jarreau singing.
Correct.
And was this, like, heavily produced with all kinds of multi-tracking, overdubbing and that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's surprising how close they could get in live performance, though. But, yeah, a lot of the keyboard stuff was overdubbed, some of the percussion. But the basic band was still, you know, piano, bass, and drums. And when I say piano, it was usually at this time Fender Rhodes piano, but sometimes acoustic piano. But then at least one synthesizer track over that, and there was extra percussion. But, yeah, it was heavily produced, but still the sell was Al Jarreau's voice and the way he sang.
And he had an album about this time called Jarreau, and we'll find out what was in that and follow him forward, too, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Kurt Dietrich, and he is the author of Never Giving Up, The Life and Music of Al Jarreau. And we're sampling generously from the recordings of Al Jarreau, made mostly from what we'll be hearing in the 70s and 80s, but he had a very long career indeed. And before we get into that album that I mentioned a minute ago, Kurt Jarreau, we want to drop back and pick up a song that is one of the highlights of his career. Now We're in This Love Together.
Right. And this was his one big pop hit. Breaking Away, the album it was on, was his first and I think probably only platinum album. And everybody said, who was in his inner circle, this was the lamest tune on the album, and it was the big hit. It was the one that the public loved.
Song that we love to sing every time we
we hear the music, and we're in this love together. We got the kind that lasts forever. Like berries on the vine, it gets sweeter all the time.
What makes it so lame?
It's just simple. Uh-huh. And I shouldn't say it's lame, but that was the exact word that somebody who I talked to used. And actually, when they got the demo of this, it was a country song from Nashville.
Wow, that's a stretch for me.
Yeah, well, you hear Al Jarreau sing it, and it is not a country song. And so, you know, that was part of what people couldn't get by who heard its original thing. And even the guy who wrote the song said years later, he said, you know, that is not a great song, but Al Jarreau sang it perfectly, and so it became a big hit.
Now, what about this album, simply called Jarreau, from 1983, where at this point Al Jarreau is really he's on a run, isn't he?
He is. And the opening cut of this album is called Mornin'. And this was a good single hit also. And it's a beautiful song, as maybe opposed to We're In This Love Together. And this also is heavily produced. And what's funny, and I would encourage listeners to go check on the internet to look at the video that went with this tune. It's animated, except for Al Jarreau, and he's interacting with a whole bunch of little creatures and the Golden Gate Bridge and the woods and you name a bowl of cereal. I mean, it's crazy. The words are kind of crazy, but the song is gorgeous. And only Al Jarreau, and he was, you know, 43 years old at this time, could have pulled off this video. He just had a thing about him that it seemed like, yes, life is good, and this is where we are, and I want to believe what's here.
hits that high note, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's an A for those of you men that are out there singing. And he was a baritone, but yeah, he really nails that. And
touched the face of God there.
Exactly. You got it.
Yeah, he did have quite a range, didn't he?
He did.
Had some wonderful low notes, too, that he liked to kind of hit and hang on to. Did he ever do funk?
Oh, yeah. And we're going to listen to a little bit of the tune that was right after Morning on the album. Morning on the album. And, yeah, this is seriously funky, and it's about what funk was like early in the 80s. And it was different from the straight-ahead R&B things he did later in his career, but it's pointing in that direction for sure. So,
and this is?
Boogie Down.
Rhythm in that is not a pushover.
No, it's not. He worked with very skilled players, and they worked hard in the studio and made those things come off. One other thing I would say about this tune, it's called Boogie Down, and you just think of it as a dance song. However, the words are suggesting that, you know, you can be what you want to, is what it says. And he later on especially talked about this song as this is about working hard on yourself and becoming what it is that you want to, but you have to work at it. And that you did that by getting your boogie down.
Yeah. He said later in life, I'm still working on me.
Yeah. Yeah.
In a few words, unfortunately, how would you describe the career how would you describe the career trajectory of Al Jarreau from the 80s all the way up till the 2010s?
Well, definitely the 80s were the highlight of his career in terms of the market and how many records he was singing and so forth. And during the 90s especially, there were several times when he took a few years off from recording, not always at his choice. It was record companies and it was the market and so forth. But he never gave up. I'm sorry to use the phrase like that, but really he never did. And he continued to tour his whole career. And then around 2000, he signed a new record deal. And from then on, he made records at fairly regular intervals and some very good records later on. Some of the ones in the 90s are questionable. But so he kept doing what he was doing, and he had fans not just in the United States, but he was very possibly a bigger star in Europe than he was in the United States.
Happens, doesn't it?
It does. And he toured in South Africa. He toured in Eastern Europe. He toured in Japan and so forth. So he was an international star.
Is he looking back in that song after all?
It's kind of a love song, and you might take it that way, but it shows him as a beautiful ballad singer.
Mm-hmm. was a time I knew that no matter come what may, love would prevail. And then inside the dreams I knew came the question lovers fear, can true love fail? Then I would miss the childhood wish, and haven't I sung to you of the knight in armor bright, faithful and true to you, darling, after all?
Kurt Dietrich, thanks for sharing the life and music of Al Jarreau with us.
Well, thanks so much for having me on the show.
He's the author of Never Given Up, The Life and Music of Al Jarreau, published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press in 2023. I'm Norman Gilliland. Our engineer is Tom Blight, and this is University of the Air.
Is the night in armor bright, faithful and true?